This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We've seen a problem with Am Yisrael developing right from Baal Otika, starting with the manifestation of the problem in the difference between the approach of Moshe and the approach of Yoshua to aspiring young Talmidei Chachamim. Shlach Lecha, the problem was crystallized with the people needing to see Eretz Yisrael before they could fight for it, and the Rebbeinu Shalom having to allow them to go and have a look. In order to stimulate their interest and arouse their interest, he had to allow it reluctantly, because really the emotional commitment to God himself should have been sufficient for them to be motivated to fight. On to Korah, where we saw the degeneracy in a sense of the people and the extent to which Moshe and Aaron were taken for granted, to the climax last week, where God starts trying to rectify the problem and to solve the problem, and Moshe and Aaron make a mistake and deprive him of the possibility. And then we're left in midair. So we've got a situation where a problem has been developing, the problem has reached grave proportions, we haven't yet seen the solutions on the horizon to the problems. And all of a sudden, Vayar Balak ben Zipporah v'asher asah Yisrael ha'amori, the scene is removed right out of the Jewish people, and we start looking at some side actions, things that are happening behind the scenes of which the Jewish people aren't even aware. They're carrying on in their little way, having their little arguments and moving towards Israel slowly, and davening in the morning and davening in the afternoon and davening at night, learning a little bit, and meanwhile there's chaos going up on the hills around them that they don't even know about. What's going on? Balak ben Zippor, the king of Moab, he's getting scared. He's heard funny things about these people. They seem to have a certain power, and his country is the next in line. Quite unbeknown to the people who we've been learning about, and this is my first question, why are we suddenly suspended? And we're not told what happens, and we never get back to it. After this, at the end of the Seder, we come back to the Jewish people, but then it talks about Pinchas, and then it goes on with Pinchas, and then it goes on with other things, and that's the end of our beautiful theme that we've been developing over all these weeks, just never gets anywhere. So what happens on the hills? Moab is getting worried, and the king sends for Bilam. Balak realizes that this is no ordinary people, and their strength is not purely a military strength, and it can't be met with all the military might in the world, but they have some superior strength. And he decides they're being led by Moshe. Moshe's counterpart is Bilam. He's the guy who can meet Moshe and possibly outdo Moshe in Moshe's own area of strength. So he comes along to Bilam, asking Bilam to go and curse the people. Bilam says, look, I can't do it without asking God, hang around a moment. He asks God, and God says, no, out of the question. You won't go with them, you won't curse the people because they're blessed. It's quite out of the question. Goes back to the people, he says, sorry, can't do anything. God's refused to let me go. So they went off. Balak wasn't satisfied with this. He thought that he's got to try and twist Bilam's arm, and he sends more important people with bigger bribes. And he says to them a fascinating statement. Bilam says to them, if Balak were to give me his whole palace full of silver and gold, out of the question for me to disobey Hashem even to do the tiniest thing. Cannot be done. I spoke this morning with Glenn Hazel about that pasuk, and whether it is or it isn't an indictment to us. Right. Even the slightest thing, is that if God says no, that's up. This is Bilam HaRosha, that wicked man Bilam, out of the question to do anything which God doesn't want. Okay, all that I can understand. The next sentence I can't understand. He says to them, "Va'atash guna v'azega matem halayla," but you know, once you're here already, sleep over the night. Maybe God will carry on last night's conversation with me, and I might have some more to tell you tomorrow. And so it is. God comes to Bilam at the night. If the people have come to call you, what does that mean? If the people have come to call you, God knows what they come for. Kum leichitam, go. Let me go to do what I tell you to. But God's changed his mind. First he says, don't go. Now he says, go. Okay, so he says, go. Vayakum Bilam baboker vayachavoshet atano. Bilam gets up the next morning and saddles his ass. Vayelechim sarei Moab, and he goes with the messengers of Moab. And the next sentence is the most fascinating of all. Vayicharaf Elokim ki holechu, and God gets angry that he's going. Vayityatzev malach Hashem baderech l'satan lo, and he puts a messenger, he puts an angel in the way to stop him. But he's just told him he can go. Doesn't make any sense. So that he puts an angel to stop him. Okay. Then comes the whole story that he meets up with the angel, the donkey sees it, moves to the side, hurts his foot and he hits the donkey, and so it goes on. Eventually the donkey talks to him and he talks back to the donkey, and then God shows the angel to him and says, "Oh yeah, yeah, I didn't realize you were there. I'm very sorry. Vayomer Bilam el Malach Hashem, and Bilam says to the angel of God, "Hatati, oh yeah, I'm sorry. I've sinned. I didn't know that you would be standing here waiting. If you think this is a bad idea for me to go, I'll turn back." Fair enough. What does the angel say? No, go. What's going on? Does God want him to go or doesn't want him to go? What's he playing games with? So he goes. In dealing with the first question, the first reaction of God after Balak decides, after Bilam decides to go, Rashi says, before we come to Rashi, let's just see the thing properly. We've dealt with before the whole question of the predetermination of will and we've discussed the fact that one doesn't have much of a choice as to what situations you put in. You're born in a place, you're born to parents, you're born to a family, you find yourself in a school, and so your life goes on. And then the psychiatrists and psychologists tell us that our characters are really molded, and that all our later decisions are based on earlier decisions, and so on and so forth. And if they are right, there's very little free choice in the whole thing altogether. Which is possible, and it suits us to believe, in fact, because that would explain very nicely the fact that things are mapped out to us, for us in a big way long before we're born. In that case though, where does the individuality come in? We've discussed that in the attitude you take to the situation you find yourself in. Trevor raised it in his talk about Viktor Frankl as well. You're free to do it the way you want. That's it. You might find yourself in a situation, but how you do it is your business. Let's look at here what Bilam does. The first reaction of God to Bilam is no, you can't go. The Mephoshim discuss why the change of mind, and they say that God finds himself in a similar situation to what he found himself with the spies. You remember, he found himself in an anomalous situation. The spies needed to see Israel in order to have the strength and the power and the courage to fight for it. They shouldn't have needed to see it. It should have been enough to have known from God that it was something worthwhile, but they did need to see it. Now what happens? If God says yes, you can send them, he's coming down to their level of lack of Ahavat Hashem, which we discussed. If he says you can't see the land, they really won't have the courage and they won't conquer the land. So he's in a situation where once they've raised the question, he has to let them go. Bilam wants to go. Says Rashi, when God says the second time, if these men have come to call you, if you feel in control of the calling, you understand what they want from you, and they've just come to call you for something which is not against my will, and you can make some money out of it, go. I'm not going to stand in the way of you making money. So God is basically opening before him another opportunity, another situation, in which he can succeed or fail. Then comes the bad thing. Vayakom Bilam Baboker Vayachavoshet Atono. Does that ring a bell at all? That's definitely. Abraham with Vayera. Exactly the same. What did Rashi say there? When you're in love, you do crazy things. You get up at the crack of dawn and you go and you fix up the donkey yourself, although you've got servants to do it. You do things that a man of your stature should never do. When you're in love, that's what it is. Abraham was in love and off he went. What the Hashem gets angry about is that Bilam gets up at the crack of dawn, gets up early in the morning, and he himself gets the donkey ready. He's so excited with the opportunity to go and curse the people, to go with his people, where he knows that God isn't happy about it. God's letting him go, going to make a bit of money. But happy about it, he isn't. And Bilam goes with this kind of enthusiasm, with this kind of joy, with this kind of simcha. That's what Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't like. This answers the old question that's been puzzling a lot of people morally since the war, the claim of the Germans carrying out orders. I say on the basis of this, maybe they're right. German carrying out orders. We are told that we have to give our life rather than to murder somebody else. But I don't know whether that's one of the mitzvahs that they are bound by. They're bound not to murder, but whether they're bound to that extent, I don't know. I haven't gone into it. But one thing I do know. They enjoyed it. They remained sane at the end of it. They didn't go mad. The German people started functioning normally straight afterwards. And the reports that we've had back of the sadism, of the smiles on their faces, of the enthusiasm, of the brains and work that went into dreaming up the schemes of killing the Jews, the efforts that each man did to do, put in to do his job properly, chas v'sholom, we shouldn't let the Fuhrer down a little bit on this important mission, that they're going to have to pay for. The fact that they remain normal and the fact that they remain sane, the fact that they got up early in the morning to do the job and to do it properly, that they're going to have to pay for. And that's much worse than actually killing the Jews. Killing the Jews, maybe they had to. Maybe that was a situation into which they were put and they couldn't get out. But they didn't have to enjoy it. And the Ribbono Shel Olam gets wrong with Bilam for exactly that reason. I'm not angry with you going. I'm angry with the way you're going. And Rashi actually says it. Ra'asha adavar ra'asay ne'amakom. He saw that the thing was in principle bad to God. Venit aveh leilech. Not that he went, Rashi adds in the word, venit aveh. And he craved to go. He was dying to go. It's for that dying to go that God gets him. That's all he's angry about. There, my people are, and you're dying to go and curse them. That you have to go is bad enough, but that you're dying to go, that I can't take. Then he puts the angel over there. And Bilam asks the angel of Shinar, should I turn back? The angel says no. And actually says a weird thing there too. Leichei my Nashim, go with the men, says the angel, and adds Rashi, ki chalkechai ma'em, because you belong with them, v'sochali abed min ha'olam, and you deserve to be destroyed like them. That's not really fair when a man asks you a shayla. Should I go? Shouldn't I go? You say yes, because you deserve to be destroyed. And Rashi before that brings in the famous statement that we had often, b'derech she'adam rotze leilech mulichinoto, if you really want something, not only does the Ribbono Shel Olam assist you in getting it, but molichimoto, he schleps you. You've decided you want to get there, and you really want to get there. Molichimoto, he'll take you and he'll not only lead you, but he'll schlep you, he'll pull you, he'll drag you, he'll get you there. You don't have to worry. All you need is that rotzen, you've really got to want it. And if you really want something that's not good for you, you'll get it too. In that case comes the question, what does God put the angel there for? He shouldn't have asked the shayla. It's exactly like the slaves, like the spies. When Bilam saw the angel standing in the way, when he saw that one thing after another was getting in the way, what Bilam should have done was quietly gone home, forgotten about the whole thing. To ask the shayla, to say, should I go, shouldn't I go? You've already gone too far. You have to go, because if you won't be able to sit at home in peace, the same as the first time you couldn't. God told you no, and you again they came. And when they came again, you nagged the Ribbono Shel Olam again, and again he gave in. And the Gemara actually says that you see from here that chutzpah afilu klape shmaya mahani, that to have chutzpah, to have a chutzpah, it works even with the Ribbono Shel Olam. If you're persistent, if you nag him, he gives in. But he gives in not out of weakness. He gives in because if that's what you really want, then handle it. You're going to get it. Bilam is a case of a man with tremendous potential. We've discussed this before. a man of whom the Gemara says, Lo kam bi Yisrael ke Moshe od Navi, there's never been among the Jews a Navi like Moshe, aval b'umot ha'olam kam, but among the non-Jews there have been, and it's Bilam. The Mefoshim go into what way he is like Moshe and what way he isn't, but we see he's a man of incredible stature, an incredible vision and perception, a man who's able to communicate directly with the Ribbono Shloma. And this man, what's gone wrong with him? Why, where has he missed the point? He's a Rosha, he's a wicked nobody who lives a miserable life, has a sexual relationship with his donkey, takes pleasure in cursing people, a man with the potential, so to say, of Moshe Rabbeinu. Look how he's turned out. It's interesting to compare these two characters. Moshe Rabbeinu reaches the highest levels that have possibly been able to be reached consistently. He keeps at it and he builds it up. And this fellow Bilam reaches a couple of peaks and he drops to the very depth of the gutters that nobody else is capable of dropping to. He's a man of passion. He's a man who knows how to love. He's a man whose love's gone the wrong way. It's really as simple as that. Rashi says over here, where he goes and he does his own ass, Mikan sha'asina mekalkelet et ashura. You see from here that hatred makes you do mad things. Which is it, love or hatred? The truth is that love and hatred are the same emotion. You often hear people talk about a love-hate relationship. It's a love-hate relationship. You love or you hate. A love-hate relationship, really love and hatred is incredibly close. The emotion is love. The question is, who do you love? If yourself is the object of that love, then you hate everybody else, because everybody else is a threat to you. If others are the object of that love, then the emotion is love. Really as simple as that. Bilam is a man who loves himself, and that's his problem. He's a man with passion, but all that passion is directed towards himself, and that explains why he needs a sexual relationship with a donkey. If there's a sexual relationship with a human being, you've got to give something. You've got to give of yourself. You've got to love someone else. That doesn't suit a Bilam. A Bilam likes to receive. He likes to be given his pleasures. Yeah, his donkey serves the purpose. That's the man he really was. A man capable of incredible love, and all that love directed inwards. One sees that also in the word that Bilam says, when he says this famous statement that if Barak would give him a house full of gold and silver. Firstly, you see that gold and silver is important. Maybe gold and silver could make me change my mind, but even that can't. This is his biggest thing. Then he said, Lo uchal la'avorat pi Hashem elatai. I am unable to transgress the words of God. And you remember a Rashi we've had a few times that says, Al yomar adam i'efshi le'echol chazer. A man must never say, I can't eat tray. He must say, I would love to eat tray. I really would. Ribbono Shel'olam says no. What's the difference? To say I can't eat tray, to exclude the possibility, God says no, therefore the possibility is excluded altogether, that's serving the Ribbono Shel'olam out of you, out of awareness, out of intellectual knowledge. God says no, it's no, that's it. Where's my Yetzer Hara for Chazer gone? It's gone, finish, cut off. God says you can't do A, B, C, D, finish, I don't feel like it anymore. That's a clock, it's not a man, that's a computer. A man is a person who says, ay, yeah, yeah, would I love to? What can I do? Not allowed? That's it. Bilam can't say that. The only way he can serve God is if he does it on the basis of lo uchal. I cannot do it. If God will enable me to do it, I'll do it. The Ava, we've discussed this previously, I see the tying in very nicely here. Serving God purely out of Yira, serving God purely out of intellectual awareness and fear must result in frustration from not doing something. Means God says, let's say for example, you like prawns. Torah says you can't eat it. There can be nothing fulfilling in not eating prawns under those circumstances. I love them, now I don't love them anymore. Finished. Torah says, no, lo uchal, I cannot. Out. Out of my picture, it's out of my frame. That must be a source of aggravation. Something you used to like and you've cut out a part of your life. There's no other way you can kill a feeling other than actually cutting it out. Whereas if one's able to overcome one's love for prawns by a greater love for God, there's no frustration there. Your emotions are being equally satisfied, better satisfied. Your dynamicism, your life cycle is all being attended to. You're living a full life and you simply You still like prawns, but you like other things better, that's all. A rabbi, a local rabbi, told me the other day that it was propositioned by a lady, one of the members of his congregation, the other day. I said, what did you do actually? How did you say? Well, it's really difficult. He says, I had a big shadow in my mind. Just to embarrass her and say, look, I'm not interested. He says, where do I get the right to make her feel inadequate? And so she's doing wrong. She's very out of bounds by doing what she's done. But just to say to her, I don't like you. He says, I'm insulting her. I don't have the right to do that. I said, what did you say? So he brought this Gemara. He said, madam, would be wonderful. The Torah says, no, I'm sorry. I said, I like you very much. I love you very much, but I love the Ribbono Shel Olam more. So it's an original way of saying it. But it's a method that leaves both parties not only not frustrated, but fulfilled. It's a fact of a feeling might remain, but they're just bigger and more important feelings than those. This is something which Bilam didn't have. There's no bigger feeling for Bilam than the need to be self-satisfied. So I come back to my first question, my very first question. What's the Torah done with telling us what happened to these Jews with their major psychological problems? The Torah took us out of the Jewish camp for a moment and said, hang on, we're getting very involved with this business. Let's try and learn from someone else. The danger of building up a passion, which is the next job that the Jews had to do, you'll remember, is start to build up a yetzer, start to learn how to function in a normal living society, where they're going to have to work for a living, where they're going to have to run a country, where they're going to have to interrelate, where they're going to have to pray for what they get. They can't use this magic wand anymore. It's all going to have to be work. There's going to be no Moshe, no Aaron. It's a new style of living. They're going to develop passion. Watch out. You know a fellow called Bilam. You don't even know about him, Jews, but up in the mountains there, there's a guy who had the potential of being a Moshe Rabbeinu. And because he developed the passion and misdirected it, he nearly destroyed you and himself in the process. Watch out from Bilam. And the Jews didn't watch out from Bilam. What happens at the end of the story? These wonderful, wonderful Jews, which they were, who have been saved and treated so wonderfully by the Ribbono Shel Olam, by Yeshiv Yisrael, by Shittim, and the Jews are sitting in Shittim, by Yachel La'am Lizmatel, but not Moab. All of a sudden, there's a prostitution and sexual relationships between the Calabars there. They went over to Swaziland, which was just over there, and then Moab. The same Moab that's been plotting to wipe out these Jews, the same ones that consulted Bilam. And while on the mountains around about, this is what's been going on, what we've just been reading about, this whole discussion and the blessings and the curses, etc., etc. Down below, what's happening? They're having a good time. They've developed passion. Something's been going on over the last couple of years that we've been out of touch with them. While we've been learning about Bilam, we left them the last time at Mei Merivah, when they had missed an opportunity to learn how to develop passion. That wasn't the end of the story. They continued to learn how to develop, and they developed it very successfully. And there was trouble. Was misdirected, the same as Bilam. So this little portion at the end belongs in the Sedra of Balak, because the Jews suffered from the same problem that Bilam suffered from. Were it not for one man. Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen v'yakom mitoch ha'edah v'yikach romach b'yado. Pinchas gets along, and Pinchas is the Hadudim of a Kanaï. A Kanaï, we discussed a couple of years ago when we did Pinchas, is a man who acts where there's a situation of wrong out of spontaneous anger. Logical anger, it's not anger. He's got to be a man whom we're satisfied is on the level of being able to be purely angry with somebody else without any kind of self-involvement, and he can be judged for that. The Sanhedrin is entitled to examine him very carefully to make sure that he is really on the level of being able to hate an action without hating the person. And if he's not, he's held up for murder. But if he is on that level, which Pinchas was, out of pure anger, he's allowed to kill in such a situation. A Jew and a non-Jew having a relationship, he took a spear and he killed them both. The din with the Kanai is that you can't even ask a shayla. You can't even go along and say, may I kill them? Because that's not spontaneous anymore. It's got to be a spontaneous action. What's the importance of that spontaneous action? If it's done that way, again, provided the man is a tzaddik, then it's an act of ahava, it's an act of love for the Ribbono Shel Olam. That means I'm not angry with him, I've got no furibul with him, but I can't stand what he's doing to God. That's it. For example, if one loves another human being very much, and the other human being is being threatened, one might in anger kill the first human being. You might have to hang for that. That might be murder. You might be killed in self-defense by the other fellow. But when you're in love, you do all sorts of strange things. This is one strange thing which the Torah condones, which the Torah allows. If you're in love with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and somebody is angry in that love relationship, and you want to take the law in your own hands under these circumstances, you can. And what does the Ribbono Shel Olam say as a result of that? At the beginning of the next week's session. He's removed my anger from the people of Israel by taking my side in anger against them. As a result of that, in my anger, I didn't destroy the people of Israel. Therefore say, I'm declaring with him a covenant of peace. I'm giving the equivalent of the Nobel Peace Prize. What's Pinchas done? Pinchas has taken the passion which had been developed, which had been misdirected by the Jews to the girls of Moab rather than to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and he'd shown the true relationship between those two passions. And he'd shown that when there's a conflict between the passion turns towards oneself, because these relationships with the daughters of Moab weren't love relationships. Fun relationships. And when there's a conflict between a fun relationship and a love relationship, the love relationship comes first, even if it means killing the fun relationship. In other words, he put the thing in its right perspective, and he showed how far ha'ava metalkelet et hashura goes, how far it goes that when you're in love with the Ribbono Shel Olam, there's nothing that stands in the way. And that this passion which the Am Yisrael had developed finally had to be directed towards the Ribbono Shel Olam and not towards anything else. And this Sedra ends all the troubles of the people of Israel, in the sense of the troubles we've discussed over the last few weeks. There's no more any complaining, there's no more any nonsense. All the inadequacies we've had over the last few weeks, all the problems resulting from their lack of passion, from the moment of Pinchas are resolved, and it never happens again. From here on, they start building on a foundation which has been established over the last few Sedras, and culminates with the act of Pinchas. Questions. That the Ribbono Shel Olam got angry with Bilam for what? Not for going, not for the action he did, but for the way he did it. And let's assume that the same will apply to these miserable Germans. Sorry, Richard.
Okay.
let's say also, which is possible, but they could have been excused had they done it with tears running down their faces, had they done it in a way that made them all go insane, they'd done it at the force of gunpoint, they would have been excused. So what is the Ribbono Shel Olam punishing them for? Not for killing Jews, for the way you kill Jews. Let's look at the other side of the coin, doing mitzvahs. If there's nothing wrong, if the Ribbono Shel Olam wasn't punishing Bilam for doing the Aveira itself, because the circumstances required that he went, but only for the way in which he did it, then one has to ask oneself about the mitzvahs we do. Again, if you ask the psychiatrist, Ms. Trevor, if they ask, if we went to a psychiatrist and we said, you know, why did I put on tefillin this morning? And you find a reason why, no? It's guilt, it's this, it's that. You'll find a whole lot of reasons that there's no, I had to put on tefillin this morning. No fancy love of God on my part, right? I've always fought against that, but now I'm prepared to say maybe they got a point. And there's nothing to be proud about having put on tefillin because the psychiatrist, I had no option. But if the punishment of God in a situation of a Bilam is entirely the quality of the action, the way he did it, let's understand the importance on the obvious side of doing a mitzvah. One finds there's a little book that the Chofetz Chaim wrote just about the mitzvah of learning Torah. And he based that book on the pasuk that says in Tevakshena Kesef Matmonim Tichafsena, if you search for Torah
like one searches for silver and you seek it like you seek for treasures, then you can understand Yiras Hashem. And he and other Mephoshim go out of their way to say that that's a fact. What the Torah is saying is that if you don't search that way, you have no chance of understanding a piece of Gemara and what it's all about. And he develops this to what does it mean to search that way. Living in South Africa, we understand it better than they understand it in Shalavim with respect. Because in Shalavim they finish work at 4:30. Here one sees people digging gold out of the mouth. You see the money that goes into it. You see the brain that goes into it, into working out. You see the sleepless nights that go into it. You see the sweat and labor of the laborers. The depth down to which they go, the heat under which they're operating, the pressures under which they're operating, the health hazards under which they're operating. You see the Mesivus Nefesh because you read in the papers every couple of days of people being killed in the mines.
Learn the way they work on the gold mine. As Tavin Yiras Hashem, then you've got a chance, maybe. Then you'll understand what Yiras Shemayim is all about. Then you'll understand what Torah is all about. And he talks about the concept at length. And let's just see a couple of things. Number one, if one operated in one's business the way one operates in a Beis HaMidrash, that's the first thing to notice a little bit in terms of time usage, in terms of effort, in terms of energy. Number two, you say to your wife, I'm busy on a massive deal. This can bring in an absolute fortune. Chances, 50-50. The more I work, the harder I work, the better the chances. The money is only going to come in 25 years' time. But it will be secure. 25 years' time, it's going to come, it will be there. But it won't raise our standard of living until then, or 30 or 35 years' time, or even if you said we won't benefit from it at all, but our children will. But it means that I'm really hardly going to see you for the next 2 years. I've got to work full out on this. What do you think the wife's going to say? Go ahead, my darling. Please, you should have mazel and brocha and rebona shalom should help you. If you say to a wife, I'm sorry, I'm busy on a difficult piece of Gemara, I've got to go to my chavrusa tonight, I just cannot work it out. Another night, again, what's going on? All the time, and I never see you, and you're in the office during the day, and you're working during the night, and is your chavrusa more important than I am? What's happening? You know, we're going to need the money for another 40 years, 50 years, some of us maybe 60 years, and then we're not going to need it anymore. When we've got an eternity ahead of us, we're going to need an awful lot of money. The money for which you have to work as hard as you work for your other money. The only trouble is, you need physical money for 60 years, let's say, not even. You're supported till you're 25 and you live another 50 years in it, Hashem. So you need money for 50 years and you can work for money for 50 years. That's a reasonable sort of situation for God to put us in. But we need Torah for an eternity. You've got to keep busy up there after you're dead. Forever and ever and ever, you've got to have enough to keep you going and enough learning and enough dynamicism. And how long do you have to get it? The same 50 years that you have to collect your money that you needed for one lifetime. So if you say to your wife, we've got a long, long retirement ahead of us. It starts at the age of 75 or 80 and it goes on for millions of years. Just millions of years. I'm going to be an awful guy to live with during that period of retirement, you must understand, if I'm frustrated. And in order to be frustrated, I'm going to start saving up now. I've got the opportunity to do a deal with a lifetime. I can understand the choices that can keep me busy for millions of years up there if I just get this choices. But I've got to do it now, this is available now. She should also understand. In Tavakshena Kekeser, if you're going to search for it, if you're going to handle with it like you handle with money, she's got to understand too that she benefits from that as directly as you do. It requires a bit of Mesivus Nefesh, it requires a bit of effort. And the prophets are, fortunately or unfortunately, stored away for quite a while. We don't get them immediately always. It gets a little bit of better, but the basic stuff is put away for a long time. As Tavin Yiras Hashem, then we can have a chance of getting to grips with what it's all about. The piece of Gemara that we're doing at the moment, as an example, the piece of Gemara a lot of the guys are complaining about. Can't get to grips with it. All that means is that you're not doing it in a business-like fashion. This was a business problem. You would apply yourself mentally and time-wise very differently to the way you're applying it if it's only a Gemara problem. It's a business problem of far greater proportions than any business problem that Harry Oppenheim ever had. It's far more urgent. It has to be understood, it has to be mastered, and it has to bring pleasure, it has to satisfy one, fulfill one. And we're going to spend a lot of time on it because it's a model sugya. It's a perfect example of how a sugya is constructed, number one. Number two, of how your enjoyment of it is directly proportional to the effort you put into it. It's going to be misery for some of you, and it's going to be heaven for some of you. And who's going to be the son or the other is going to be entirely dependent on you. Those who are in their offices early, and they sit and sweat away, and they apply themselves to the business problem, are going to solve the business problem. It's going to be good. And those that come into the office half an hour late, and they leave half an hour early, and they take an extra half an hour over lunchtime, and they slouch in their chairs between morning and lunchtime, and they stop for coffee, and they stop again for tea, and they phone their wives 6 times to check up that everything's alright, those people are going to have no pleasure out of it, and no happiness out of it, and no will they want. One has to understand that it's not just the act of learning. We're not just here to learn or to do the mitzvahs that we're doing. We're here to do it the opposite of the way Balak did it, or rather to do it the way Bilam did it. We should go about our Torah with as much enthusiasm as Bilam went about his wishes, his wickedness, and we'll be okay.